Welcome to CeltCast, the bi-weekly podcast from the Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching at Concordia University, Wisconsin in Ann Arbor. Your hosts, Rob Balza, Kate Robertson, and Carrie Bierke, bring you conversations with professors and thought leaders from around the world, sharing fresh insights on teaching and learning. This academic year, 2025-26, we're focusing on one of the most transformative forces in education today, artificial intelligence. Whether you're a faculty member, educational leader, or simply passionate about learning, CeltCast is your space to explore ideas, spark curiosity, and imagine the future of education together.
All right, welcome. Today's guest is Dr. Tim Requarth, Research Assistant Professor of Neuroscience and Psychology and Director of Graduate Science Writing at NYU Grossman School of Medicine. And Dr. Requarth earned his PhD in neuroscience from Columbia University before transitioning into an influential career in science journalism and communication. His work has appeared in major publications, including The Slate, New York Times, Foreign Policy, Scientific American, and many others. Additionally, he served 9 years as director of NewWrite, an international workshop that brings scientists and writers together to refine how scientific ideas are communicated. At NYU, Dr. Requarth now shapes the future of science communication by developing graduate-level courses and curricula focused on writing and pertinent to today, the responsible use of AI in scientific communication. His latest article in The Transmitter we'll link to in the show notes, and that's how we got first connected with you, Tim. Welcome to the show, and I'm excited to explore how neuroscience and writing converge and how AI is reshaping the way we tell scientific stories and teach in our classrooms. So to get started, could you tell us about your first experience in AI, like how you first got interested in the topic, like what that experience was like? We all have that first experience story with AI right now.
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk about some of my favorite things and also some of the most troubling things in the world today around education, writing, and intellectual work. So this is a very exciting time.
For sure.
You know, the funny thing is my first introduction to this kind of stuff was actually in graduate school before ChatGPT was a household name. You know, I was a neuroscientist and I was at Columbia and I worked a lot with a theoretical neuroscientist. And so building neural networks and these sorts of things was that was something that was one of our tools and something that we studied back then. And so many of the people that I either directly collaborated with or worked with went on to work for some of these companies that are now building these models. So I just want to say that it's something I've been thinking about for a long time. How AI is or isn't similar to the brain, what it can or can't do. I think what surprised everybody is actually how good ChatGPT ended up being, right? Like how, even though it is essentially a really fancy autocomplete, it's really can do things like pass exams and impersonate people to surprising degrees. So it raises these very deep questions even about what intelligence is. But I don't think we need to get distracted by all of that at this moment. But I just wanted to say that these are questions that I don't think even people who are very much on the inside of thinking about the brain, thinking about AI, thinking about its capabilities, were caught off guard when this technology burst onto the scene a few years ago. So that's just to say that educators shouldn't feel bad. Like this was a surprise, right? It's in some ways, it's a surprise that we're all now dealing with. And we can talk about that a little bit later.
Sure.
My first experience with this particular technology. So, you know, AI gets used to mean a lot of things. And I think what we're all interested in right now is generative AI and these latest large language models and the associated software ecosystem around them. So that would be like ChatGPT 3.5, which was publicly released in, I think, November 2022, maybe, or 2023. So the time is fuzzy at this point. That's the one that made the big splash. They've been incrementally improved since then. When it first came onto the scene, I knew that I would have to deal with it. My role at NYU is teaching scientists, you know, how to write. And this occurs at the student level, but I also engage with the postdocs and faculty. they wanted to know, are these new tools helpful or harmful? Are they legit? I had to wrestle with them. So I think there was a lot of people that at the beginning put their head in the sand because it complicated things that they didn't want complicated. And I
Sure.
really understand that. I really do. But my first experience was, I've got to figure out if these are up to, what can I actually tell people about what they want to do with them. And the thing that motivated me at that moment was in thinking about science as an enterprise, as sort of a human enterprise. The goal of it is not to write papers or to write grants. The goal of it is to advance technology, to advance knowledge, to develop treatments. Writing in that case is in service of that larger or deeper intellectual or societal goal of science. And so
Sure.
I didn't want to be too precious about the writing process, and I wanted to ask the question carefully: in what ways does writing serve those process that process, and what ways does it get in the way of that process? Because there are many great scientists whose ideas may not see the light of day because they're poor communicators, and that could either be due to, some natural proclivities or disparities in training or whatever it is. I thought that would be something I could figure out in a few years. It has proven to be a much knottier problem than I thought. And I just bring that up because that is the central question, I think, whether we're talking about education or a seasoned writer, is how is writing or a process that some process that AI can now do, how is that, what are the deeper goals? And how is that process serving them or working against them?
Yeah, my first experience with AI was around that 2022 with that ChatGPT 3.5 release. And I remember one of the first things that I did, it was, just copy and paste in some of my favorite exam questions as a biology professor. And it was a bit shocking to see, how good, I mean, not perfect. I mean, there are clearly flaws and I could easily trick it by playing around a little bit. And that was my first impression was, well, I've got to rework my questions to make sure I'm asking things that ChatGPT can't do. And that's gotten more challenging as it's gotten better and updated the last few years. One of the interesting stats in your article that really caught my eye was you mentioned that 70% of undergraduates want more instruction in AI, but only about a third of faculty are, have integrated AI into the courses, and even fewer, I think the stat you cited was 14% are comfortable doing something like that. And you shared like a panic email you got from a colleague, what counts as plagiarism anymore? Like, how do we govern these kinds of things? And I've had faculty, I know Kate said the same thing, that come in and say, all right, I'm teaching English to non-native speakers and they're writing in Chinese and using AI to translate to English. Does that mean they're actually writing? Like, what am I actually trying to do here? And so it's forced us to ask a lot of questions. And anyway, I'm curious why you think professors have been so slow, to develop, to incorporate AI into their classes, to respond to that student demand.
I mean, I think first of all that, we just have to take a moment that professors as a class of people did not design this technology. It was put out into the world. It's immensely disruptive of educational systems that have been in place for decades, and it's unreasonable to expect faculty to adapt to this in a couple of years, even. Right. So I think that's the first thing. I think I want to just assuage faculty guilt, right, of saying like, man, I should really have figured this out by now. This is a real curveball that nobody asked for, and that there's a lot of stuff we don't have control over, right? We don't have control over students being able to access it, for example. One could have imagined a world in which this technology was rolled out, and it was rolled out in a way where it was made available to people building educational technology and then released to students in such a way that it was only able to be used in constructive ways. In that sense, it could be a very powerful learning tool because AI does have, I think, some very powerful learning, some promise. But the way that it was rolled out instead is unfettered access to the full range of power to anybody with an internet connection. And that makes it that gives you two problems, right? One problem is you at the same time you have to figure out what are some good uses of this technology that can help our students. And then the second question, which is frankly much harder, is how do we prevent them from using it in harmful ways that's harmful?
Right.
And because of this, and I just want to acknowledge, because of this, it's not like faculty's wrestling with, well, how can we make this work for our students? What advice can we give them to use it in ways that are going to build them as build their intellect? They're working in an environment where it's a free-for-all. And so that just makes it a much more complicated, that makes it a much more complicated question. So I just wanted to start with, I think it's fine to be caught off guard. And I don't think that anybody magically has like the right answer to this, because I think the questions that AI raises about what you're teaching, why you're teaching it, what students want to get out of an education, what an education is for, those are, it really does strike at the core of some of the things that higher education is doing. And I think it's prompting some, you know, the maybe the initial reaction was detect and punish. And I think at this point, people are moving beyond that, maybe both out of pragmatism, but both out of a useful reconsideration of how we can improve higher education experience for students.
Sure. And that's I know our faculty who listen to this will be very appreciative of your understanding, because I think it's such a shift in how some of our faculty are thinking. I mean, for example, in your article you state that, AI may enhance short-term performance, but at the cost of long-term learning. And I really think that that accurately sums up what faculty are nervous about surrounding
Yeah.
AI. So if you were counseling faculty, what would be some initial steps that you would recommend faculty take to adjust their teaching to more focus on that long-term learning versus the short-term performance?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think that the first thing is to distinguish between times when performance is important and times when learning is important, because I think those are two different things. And so, like, for example, if you have an autopilot system on a plane and it only crashes one in a million times, but you have a pilot in the loop and it crashes one out of 10,000 times, maybe in that case you want performance to be the best, right? You really
Sure.
want autopilot to be doing most of the work because everybody's safer. And if the pilot skills atrophy, if they don't learn as much, maybe who cares, right? So, but we're in an educational context. And I would argue that most of the time, the performance is not really that's not really the product of education, right? Those are the outputs, like the writing of the papers, the doing this problem sets, the all of those sorts of things. Those are the outputs, but the product is actually the student experience of those things, right? Nobody, there's no, what is the point of a research paper? Nobody reads it, right? The point of a research paper is not that it's going to be published and change the world, right? That's not the point of the vast majority of student research papers. So the point of them is what the student is doing during that time, what they're doing with their mind, right? What that process is. So I think that the question for teachers, right? For professors is to think about what are the underlying like core, either cognitive or social or whatever skills you want students to be building, and figure out how to teach those and assess those. And because they are now unbundled, right? We used to have those things all be within the paper, right? A paper, say, I'm just using a paper as an example because it's common, right? But a paper, it was never like a, you know, 100% a great, it had its flaws, right? We all know that. But it did ensure, you know, there was a relative relationship between effort and, you know, it reflected the effort the student had put into it, right? That's no longer potentially true. It ensured that someone could learn to logically organize their thoughts, find the right sources, do this. That's no longer true. Right. So know that now, given that those things aren't true, what about the effort was valuable? What about organizing your thoughts on a page was valuable to a student? And how can we reimagine what students are doing so that they're learning those things, but it doesn't require a research paper? You know, I
Sure.
think that's a hard, hard question. But I think that's kind of where we're at.
It's a great segue into my next thought is, about kind of directions for student writing, policies governing student writing. I've seen faculty, and here at Concordia University, we have faculty that adopt restrictive policies, basically banning the use of AI. Others that, have adopted very permissive policies, like just cite how you used it, but go nuts. And others that have what I would describe as kind of a mixed use policy, like it's okay to use in certain ways. And I got the sense from reading your article, you're kind of a mixed use kind of guy. What, can you give us some idea of what restrictions you would put on the use of AI if you were teaching some writing, to, particularly to undergraduate students?
So, I mean, it's a great question. I think that that was, as educators, and this is something I talked to you with my, colleagues at NYU as well. Having the those are three ranges, right? You say, don't use AI, use it as much as you want, or have some sort of mixed use with structured guidance. And I have done that latter one, as you say. I am less convinced of its long-term feasibility, but I think for the meantime, before we get to those deeper questions, let me just talk concretely about what I do. So for I do teach, I should just say I mostly teach graduate students that are motivated, and that's already a self-selected cohort of, for many reasons. So I just want to be very clear that, what has been successful for me in this context may not be successful for all contexts. I think that students, there's going to be some students that are going to maybe view education in an extremely transactional way, and they're going to do whatever they can to cut the cord, right? And so that is a bigger social issue that we can talk about, but like, I'm not sure if there's much you can do for that group. There's probably going to be some students that if you tell them not to use AI, they're not going to use it, and they'll just do the, they'll follow the rules, right? But there's this big middle group of students, or even different, the same student at different times, right? That really would like to do the right thing, but aren't quite sure how. And then they'll do the, maybe do the wrong thing, do something that's harmful to them. So I think you want to put yourself in the mindset of a student who has to fire up assignment. And what I have found to be the most useful is to have guidance that is right there at the point when the student would be doing the assignment. So if you have something in the syllabus way earlier that says, like, please use AI in ways that help but don't harm your learning, that's an accurate statement, but it makes a lot of assumptions that the student can identify cases where it would help or harm their learning and that they'll exhibit the self-restraint to do it, right? And so I think the first step is putting the give fleshing that out as much as possible at the point of the assignment. So for in my case, they often write things called a specific aims page, just because they're graduate students. So this would be like a essentially an abstract, as an abstract is to a scientific paper, a specific aims page is to an NIH grant. And so imagine you're having a student write something like that. I would list a what I'm having them try to learn. What a certain AI use would seem reasonable, but would actually undermine their learning. What an AI use that would be acceptable, right? So I'll really just lay it out in detail and give like a sample like workflow, right? So for this part, we really want you to be doing the ideation. So there's this is the part you should be doing without AI. When you get to this part, maybe you could try this using it in this little way. So it's really just mapping it out. So it essentially gives students a roadmap for AI use or not for a given assignment. I would say that is a great first step. I don't think it's a silver bullet. It might be it's necessary, but it may not be sufficient. But I think that helps more than students having to figure out what a professor means by don't use it in a certain way from a general statement.
I love that idea of that sample roadmap. Here's the ways you can use it ethically to increase your workflow and productivity. So many faculty that I know are, here's things you can't do, unless to know this, right? That are, here's the things that'll get you into trouble. So I love turning that on its head and, sh and showing ways that they can use it in addition.
I think it's important, and I think that that's somewhere where students, and again, no faculty asked for this to be their job all of a sudden, but this is where students would look to faculty. They don't know where a use might help or harm them. And it's the wisdom and experience of faculty Right, to say, look, I don't know what the, because we have to decouple like what's going on in the job market later, right? I mean, I know it's not maybe easy, but at this moment, right, it's very unclear exactly what's going to be happening in the it, with jobs and that stuff later. But the more equipped you are cognitively, the better you can think critically, think flexibly, have confidence in your decisions, right? That's going to allow you to adapt better to whatever the situation is than overfitting by like learning how to use one particular AI system that's current today, right? And so I think professors do have a lot of, you know, they may not be as tech savvy, but they do have a lot of wisdom. And if they do some reflection of like what parts of my assignment actually really matter, not just matter because I've done them this way for a long time, what
Right.
really matters? And that is a it's a hard ask, but I think that that's kind of faculty's role here is to do that hard thinking, because if they don't do it, then students will just make those decisions on their own. And I think that I think they want more guidance.
I
Tim, you've
think
been
you're right. Yeah, and I think too that's such a great, I just loved your analogy in your article about, hey, if you want to build muscle, you need to lift weights, but yes, you could get a forklift to do it for you or however it went. And that's, yes, faculty need to do the work, and I'm 100% behind what you said, but also I think how do we get the students to understand that, yes, you need to do this thinking and you need to do this work for yourself? So I just love that analogy. And I mean, I'm assuming you put it into print, so I'm assuming it's been successful for you. Have students given you specific feedback on that?
I think so the analogy is just, you know, if you there's a few ways you can move weights across a room, right? One of them will build muscle and one of them won't. And so if your goal is to move weights, using a forklift is fine, right? That's the performance learning difference, right? And but if your goal is to build muscle, then you need to lift the weight yourself. And I think that also gets at the distinction between learning and training, like job training, right? Job
Sure.
training is teaching someone to use a forklift, right? Learning is having someone build muscle so that they can do a variety of jobs, right? So that's also, I think, a mistake that people can get into is like, oh my God, everything's forklifts now. We need to train everybody to learn to use forklifts. And I would say,
Sure.
no, that's not right. We now have forklifts, which are, by the way, pretty easy to use. So is AI, right? The students are going to learn how to use AI just fine. Like, I have no doubt about that. I don't think college needs to be like reinvented around learning how to use AI. These systems are easy to use by design. It's going to be fine. The point is to build the muscle. So if you look at that, though, what is the hardest thing about the gym, right? It's actually not lifting the weights. The hardest thing about the gym is being motivated to go there in the first place. So I
That's
think
so
that
true.
that so that's but if you take this analogy to the classroom, you know, you can't force a student, it's very hard to force a student to learn. You have to motivate them to want to learn. And I think that if there's, you know, that is a part of the equation too, right? Is how do you motivate the students to want to go to the gym and lift the weights themselves and understand that it's benefiting them. So I think the analogy is a good one, and it does help students. But again, I think there are, if we think about, you know, there are things that get in the way of us going to the gym or keeping in shape, right? Those are the same things that students are facing. They have competing demands. They're anxious about, you know, they're very much graded on where the weights end up in the room. And so they're very anxious about that. And they're thinking, well, I have this forklift that no one will ever know if I used or not. I could spend 10 hours lifting these weights, or I could just quickly use this forklift. This isn't my most important, you know, I'll just see what it does when I use the forklift, right? That's that slippery slope.
Yes.
And you know, I think so that's why there's these bigger questions of like, what is the overall environment that students are learning in that is going to make it hard for them to go to the gym every day?
Yeah, it's a great analogy. I love that. I'm definitely going to borrow that and use that with my students someday. We had a previous guest that was, waxing poetic about how AI is going to really change what we need to do as faculty in terms of the skills we need to teach, but also it's going to impact universities like Concordia and NYU in terms of what majors and programs students are going into. And again, it's I think you mentioned this earlier, it's impossible to predict like exactly how this is going to play out, but I'm curious, your thoughts on that. Where do we see student interest migrating? Like, what kind of skills should faculty retool and start to teach their students? Or maybe what's less important moving forward?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question. I really try to stay out of the prediction game because I think it's a fool's game. And like, who would have known 4 years ago that computer science or software, would be a very hard place to get an entry-level job right now? So I was talking to some colleagues in the computer science program, and they were having their own freak out of like, well, how do we know if the students are writing their own code? There's all of these ways, AI can do code. They're all going to be everybody uses AI for coding now. And my answer was, what are they trying to learn when they code? Like, what are you trying to teach them? What matters when they code? Because AI is quite good at coding, but I mean, it's not perfect, but it's quite good. So what are you trying, like, what does it matter that they do it from scratch? Or how, just getting people to think. And I don't know the answer to that because I don't teach computer science, right? So I don't think it means like, oh, well, nobody should do coding anymore, right? Because I remember when I learned to code in graduate school, I'm certainly not a great coder by any stretch of the imagination, but it was a very empowering experience because I was able to start to understand a little bit more deeply how computers operated, understand that I could make them do things that they didn't do out of the box, and also understand that a lot of the ways that my experience on a computer unfolded was shaped by decisions that programmers had made that I had no idea about. And so I learned a lot from coding, even though it's like nothing I really use that regularly anymore. But
Sure.
if I use some AI to code something, I know how to check it to make sure it's working, how to like there's various things that I learned from having had that experience that makes me able to use it for that. So again, I think like a wholesale shift of, wow, we should not do computer science majors anymore. We should all do, AI majors. That feels like maybe an overcorrection. I think there's in the medium term, I think really thinking again about what is the core kind of experiential learning that you're going to be able to offer students, right? And maybe the AI stuff comes in a little bit later, when they're like in their in the later years of their undergraduate career, but it's thinking about what they're doing in the classroom, right? And I think that is less, it's less important like what the exact major is. I think it will become less important if I had to make any prediction of like what the exact major is, and more important, what it is preparing students to, how it's pre preparing them to think, how people are engaging students in the classroom in a way that they can't offload all of this stuff to AI, so they come out of college dependent on AI and unable to adapt to whatever the workforce throws at them. Those are ultimately going to be the better prepared and more thriving students.
Yeah, my brother works for this tech company called Salesforce,
Yeah.
and we're just having a conversation about this over the weekend. And in his job, it used to be a lot of coding, a lot of graphic design, and it's shifted more towards like project management. And what he says is he's using his kind of liberal arts background more than he used to, and less of those tech skills. So maybe the pendulum, I feel like liberal arts has kind of taken a beating over the last decade or
Yeah.
two, and it'd be interesting to see if the pendulum swings back their direction a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that, again, thinking about the kind of course, especially at the undergraduate level, it's not about information transfer as much as it is building core human to human relationship skills, organizational skills, time management skills. It's identity formation. It's a lot of these other things that happen in that very charged and intense young adulthood. And capitalizing on those to create like well-balanced, critically thinking, moral humans. Like, I think going back to the root of what higher education is for, those are the students that are going to thrive, right? It's not about showing them the latest tips and tricks with whatever AI tool everybody's using. That's job training. They'll learn that when they need to.
Sure.
Tim Rieckhorth, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure to get to know you and talk AI and the future of higher ed. And I encourage our audience to check out his recent article in the Transmitter. And knowing you and how productive you've been in the past, I'm sure there'll be more articles coming from you in the near future.
Yes,
All right.
definitely. I'll send them your way. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Thanks,
All
Tim.
righty.
Thank you for listening to CELTcast, brought to you by the Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching at Concordia University, Wisconsin in Ann Arbor. We hope today's conversation gave you something valuable to take away, whether a new idea to apply in your teaching practice or simply a perspective to consider further. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can find us on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Production for this episode was done by Ashley Curtin. Until next time, thank you for joining us and keep teaching faithfully.